Welcome, everybody, to Parshas Vayetze, Tavshin Samach Tes, 5769. Vayetze is a very difficult Parsha. It's a very difficult Parsha. Why do I say it's a difficult Parsha? Well, I would, if somebody told me it was a difficult Parsha, I might guess that it's difficult because Yaakov Avinu, who is the star of this parsha from beginning to end, has a very difficult time. And it covers a span of some 20 years. If you recall, at the end of last week, his brother Esav wanted to kill him because Yaakov received the blessings that were intended for Esav originally. They weren't really intended for Esav, but he thought they were. He was told they were. And when he found out that they weren't, he wanted to kill Yaakov. So Yaakov was running for his life. Where was he running to? He was running to his uncle, his mother's brother, Lavan, to try to find a wife, because he also had to get married. He was already 63. And time to get married. And he ended up joining the family of first-class swindler, Lavan, whose name means white, because everything he did made it look like he was white and clean, and really he was Lavan ha'arami, Lavan the Aramean, which the sages take the word letters Arami and scramble the letters so that it spells Ramai, which means deceptive one. That's really who he was. And Yaakov had to live and put up with Lavan's antics for 20 years. And Yaakov himself kind of summarizes in just a few short verses what kind of a life he had. At the end of the 20 years, he takes his family. He by now has four wives and 12 children, 11 sons and a daughter. And according to one opinion in the Talmud, he has 24 children, because each child was born with a twin, but that's not so well known. Mm-hmm. Either way, it was a large family, and he has lots of sheep and flocks, which he had amassed not through the generosity of his employer, but through the graces of God. Anyway, Lavan runs after him in sense that he left, and there's an encounter, and in this encounter, Yaakov basically summarizes the kind of treatment that he had. So I read from chapter 31, verse 41. Zeli esrim shana beveisecha. This is a summary of all that went on. This is my 20 years in your household. I served you 14 years for your two daughters. Now let's recall. First, the agreement was that he would work for Lavan for 7 years, and then he would be entitled to marry his chosen one, Rachel. At the end of the 7 years, a wedding was planned. We all know Lavan surreptitiously switched Rachel for Leah. And so he ends up marrying the daughter that he did not choose. He then says, okay, that's our custom. You can't marry off the younger one before the older one. Work another 7 years and you could marry Rachel too. So he has to work another 7 years. But you should just realize that he didn't have to wait the second 7 years to marry Rachel. He actually married Rachel the following week, after the Sheva Brachas was finished, but he still had to remain and repay the seven more years of service. So he says, I had to work for you for 14 years for your two daughters, and then 6 years for your flocks. He remained another 6 years in order to get paid. And you changed my wage 100 times. And we don't even know the details of that, but I don't imagine that Yaakov was exaggerating. Had not the God of my father, the God of Abraham and the dread of Isaac, been with me, you would surely have now sent me away empty-handed. God saw my wretchedness, the toil of my hands, so he admonished you last night. So basically he says over his tale of woe. So I would have said this is a difficult parsha because Yaakov had a difficult life. Reasonable? And especially if we think about how this parsha is maybe a foreshadowing, as some of the portion the commentaries say, it's a foreshadowing of the exile experience for the Jewish people in the future. So we're really looking at a story, what do I do?
Push your money.
Thank you. We're looking at a very unfortunate tale, and realizing that this may be the tale of our lives, and indeed it has been. Well, I don't know if we can really stay with that proposition that is why the parsha is difficult. Because if you ask Yaakov himself, so Yaakov, did you have a hard life based on this parsha? I think he would say, no, wasn't bad. For example, I read from a verse where he first wanted to marry, and he made a deal with his future father-in-law that he would work for 7 years. Now, that's pretty steep. That's a pretty steep price. A man says to a young fellow, you can marry my daughter if you put in 7 years of hard work first. Well, that's a little bit unusual.
Wasn't it
for a wage.
The first time?
Perhaps. Mm-hmm. All right, perhaps. But there must have been a reason. He was already an older man. It wasn't that he was underage. But it says, but listen to this word. Vayavod Yaakov b'Rachel sheva shanim. This is in chapter 29, verse 20. Yaakov worked for Rachel 7 years. Vayihiyu ve'enav ki yomim achadim b'yahavaso osa. They seemed to him a few days because of his love for her. Just a few days. Wasn't a big deal. It was not a big deal. We see Yaakov's attitude must have been incredible. A few days to marry the woman that you've chosen as your mate? That seems pretty superhuman if you ask me. Now, in a few verses later, actually, the next verse, after the 7 years are over, Vayomer Yaakov el Lavan, Yaakov says to Lavan, Hava es ishti ki malu yamai v'avoa eleha. Jacob said to Lavan, deliver my wife, for my term is fulfilled, and I will consort with her. You hear these words and you think like this is guy, you know, like, hold him back. You know, he's so long. He's like at the end of his rope. He's exhausted. He's frustrated. 7 years. Give me my prize. Now Yaakov picks up on this. I'll read the summary in the footnote. Jacob's expression, and I will consort with her, would have been vulgar in a lesser person. Jacob's only intent was that he was already 84 years old. 84. I thought he was 63, actually, when he left. I will come back to that. He was 84 years old, and he had to begin his mission of bringing the 12 tribes into the world. His concern was to serve God, not physical pleasure. Rashi. Okay, Rashi's words are, "Valo kal shebekalim eno omer kain." Even the lowest of the low do not speak this way. Give me my wife so that I will consort with her. Ela loholid toldos amar kach. He said this because it was his intent to give birth to the tribes, and he had to get started. He's already 84. Do you mind closing the door, Steve, behind you? Thank you. So, Yaakov, again, doesn't seem to be suffering, you know, from an emotional sense, like we would think a person has had a hard life and he's filled with frustration and disappointment and anger and resentment to things that people have done for him. He doesn't seem to have that. So I don't think that the difficulty is that Yaakov lived a hard life. I could be wrong, but I put Yaakov a little bit past that. So why do I say that it's a difficult parsha? And here's why I think it's a difficult parsha. Because how in the world can a human being who is flesh and blood live that kind of a life and say, oh, it was no big deal. Just a few days. I'm not frustrated. I'm not impatient. I'm not tired. I'm not exhausted. I'm not angry. How could a human being live a life which to us seems like pure suffering and hardship, and all he cares about is, I've got to make the tribes. It's only a few days. I love her. Which, anyways, that's counterintuitive. If he loves her, why is it only a few days? So that's, to me, the difficulty. But the difficulty is that Yaakov Avinu did live a hard life, and yet it doesn't seem like he reacted the way you and I would. That is my difficulty. So here's where we come back to our Mesilas Yesharim. Now, last week, and as I mentioned before we started, I would like to just give a brief summary of the words of last week. We spoke about two terms that were brought up in the Alei Shur, which is the Sefer by Rabbi Volba. Rabbi Volba was a student of Rav Yerucham, and he was our contemporary Musar teacher. The world. He lived in Eretz Yisrael. He was originally from Switzerland, and he kind of absorbed the Musar tradition from the great European masters like Rav Yerucham, particularly, and he came to Israel and he taught a whole new generation of the ways of the thought process of the Torah's way of life, the Musar. And he's also a psychologist par excellence, not professional a bit in his thinking and in his grasp. And Rav Yerucham says that there needs to be a recognition that we are creatures of instinct. Instinct are like kind of gut reactions that move us and animate us. And the difficult concept that I was trying to give over was that there's even an instinct to be frum. There's an instinct to be religious, but it's an instinct. And Rav Yerucham and Rav Volba says that's not the ultimate in the service of God. It's not a kind of a knee-jerk reaction to be frum. Service of God requires a transitioning from instinct into das, into knowledge. And if it's not transitioned into knowledge, then what it really is, what is this instinct? A person can have an instinct to be from, what he calls it, but really he's just self-serving and self-centered. A person can fancy himself as very accomplished in a religious sense because he does a lot of mitzvahs. I was trying to explain this concept to my son, and I said, let's say a guy is the first one to shul every morning. But he gets to shul, and somebody is standing in his way. And he says to the guy, what are you standing here for? Can't you see I'm late for shul? Can't you see I'm trying to get to shul to daven? And I'm the first one here? You're standing in my way. Right? That is a frum, self-centered maniac. That it's really just his self-serving instinct to take care of number one. but it's manifest in religion, rather than he's not running out to a bar, but he's running to shul with the same kind of instincts. And he says, that's not the way we serve God. We serve God with das, with the mind. And as you could see, two different people, they're both doing the same thing. They're both in shul and they're both davening. One person is davening out of frum instincts, and one person is serving Hashem with das. I thought of an analogy, very interesting, because das, you know, is through the mind, through the head. You know, I'm a chazan of sorts, and years ago when I used to lead services, I would my voice would start to get tired, and I would get hoarse, and I wouldn't be able to really have the stamina to go through those services, especially on the high holidays. And you know, my father has been a cantor his whole life, and his father, and my father has always been talking to me about the right way to sing and the wrong way to sing. But it's very difficult to try to understand what that means. My father said, go to, actually, Cantor Good Friend, may he live and be well. Go to him for some voice lessons. So I went. And the principle is that you're trying to sing, but not from your throat, but you're trying to sing from your head. I know this sounds crazy, and it sounded crazy to me. There's a certain way of kind of lifting your projection of your voice out of your throat. I really, it's hard to explain. And maybe you, if you know what it is, you know what I'm talking about. But there's a difference. In both cases, you're singing. But in one case, you're singing from your throat. In the other case, you're singing from a higher point. And your voice lasts longer, and it resonates more, and it sounds different. And from that point on, I have been developing my ability to sing, you know, from a higher place. And most kids and younger people, they don't know this. And it's like my father calls it the lazy way to sing and the right way to sing. Well, it's some... I like this. I liken this to serving Hashem. You can serve Hashem the lazy way, where it's really just kind of using your selfish instincts, or you can learn, and it's hard to make this transition, you can serve Hashem with your das. And the problem is that you can't just one day stop doing the first and all of a sudden doing the second. It's a transition. It's a becoming. And we'll talk about how we do that. But service of Hashem is not something which you do the lazy way. And that's what we've been talking about in the Mesilas Yesharim. Zehirus is the process of a person saying, whoa, to his instincts, learning how to self-exercise, self-control, self-restraint. It means stopping from that instinctive rush and learning how to think and learning how to decide what it is that I should be doing and doing it. It's using das. It's nullifying, negating my own will and my own desires. Because everyone just rushes to do what they have a desire to do. There's a, I guess, if we were to quote something from Mesilas Yesharim today, it would be a paragraph regarding Zrizus, which is our current virtue. And Zrizus is really the flip side of Zehirus. Zehirus is for the negative, and Zrizus is for the positive. And Rabbi Luzzatto writes that the big factor that challenges us to be Zrizus, to have alacrity, to serve Hashem with alacrity, is something which we all face. And I'm reading from the old edition because I don't have the new edition right here, but I'm sure it's fine. The factors which detract, this is the beginning of chapter 9, the factors which detract from zeal are those which promote laziness. The greatest of these is the desire for bodily repose or rest, aversion to exertion, and the love of pleasures to their very limits. There is no question that a person laboring under the above deterrent will find divine service a great burden. In other words, if a person is living life for the comforts, for the rest, for the pleasures of this world, he's going to have a hard time serving God. One who wishes to take his meal with complete relaxation and repose, to sleep without being disturbed, to walk only at a leisurely pace, and so forth, such a person will find it extremely difficult to arise for morning services, or to curtail his dinner so as to pray the afternoon service before nightfall, certainly now in the wintertime, or to go out to perform a mitzvah if the time does not suit him. How much more reluctant will he be to rush himself for a mitzvah or for Torah study? One who habituates himself to these practices is not his own master to do the opposite of these things when he so desires, for his will is bound with the bonds of habit which becomes second nature to him. So it's really a difficult chore for somebody who is living for self-gratification. A person must realize that he is not in this world for repose, but for labor and exertion. He should conduct himself according to the manner of laborers who work for hire. Or, if you like another analogy, according to the manner of soldiers in the battle line who eat in haste, sleep only at irregular intervals, and are always poised for attack. Or maybe a little more contemporary, how about a fireman or an EMT? That's pretty noble. You know, but let's look at their physical life. They're always on call. They have to be willing to drop whatever they're at, whatever they're doing, and run to the scene. But if a person accustoms himself to this approach, he will certainly find divine service easy, for then he will not be lacking the proper attitude or preparation for it. Our sages of blessed memory said along the same lines, Pirkei Avot 6:4, this is the way of Torah. Eat bread with salt, drink water by measure, and sleep upon the ground. This regimen constitutes the epitome of removal from comforts and pleasures. Now that is an extreme, of course, but the sages are saying that you have to decide, what are we here for? Are we here for enjoying ourselves, resting, relaxing? Or are we here to toil, to serve a God, and to rest later? Everlasting, real rest. Rest in the sense of enjoying the sublime company in the divine presence. So we're really talking about in this Sefer, we're really talking about in terms of religious growth, in terms of the Mesilas Yesharim, the path that we are on, the path towards God, is we're really talking about a transition from normal human instinctual living, where by and large we're here to follow our desires, be our own boss, be comfortable, be happy, live a good life, enjoy it, which really conflicts with the demands and the rigors of the Torah, and a different paradigm, a paradigm that we're here, we're soldiers, we're here to work. This lifetime is one big work day. And the sages even say that in Pirkei Avos. The day is short, the work is great. The Baal HaBayis, the employer, is pressuring us. But the rewards are beyond imagination. But that is a transition. This is Yaakov Avinu. Yaakov Avinu's legacy to us, the way that he is our father, is because he is teaching us that if you focus yourself on what we're here for, nothing in life is overbearing. Nothing is a drag. Nothing is frustrating your forward motion. The disappointments are not there. The frustration is not there. The anger, the resentment is not there. All of those reactions are for somebody who is trying to be centered, who is centered around his own will, his own convenience, his own desires. A person who is here to be in the army of God can overcome those things, can take them in stride. Instead of saying, how come I had to wait 7 years to marry your daughter? Or, how come you tricked me? He's just focused on the mission. I've got work to do. I'm supposed to have 12 children. I'm old. I need to get started. Focus on the mission. There's a beautiful insight when it says, we started off with the question, how could a flesh and blood say it was like a few days because of his love for her? That's so counterintuitive. But you know, we don't know what that means, because man meets woman. Man falls in love with woman. Does he really love the woman? Or does he really love himself? And he sees the woman as someone that can satisfy his desires. He doesn't love her. He loves himself. He loves what she does for him. Such a person has no patience. Such a person is going to kill anybody who stands in his way. But Yaakov Avinu is focused outward. He's not living the narrow existence of his own fulfillment. He is focused on the her. He's focused on the fact that she is the mother of the Jewish people. If I have to wait 7 years, fine. As long as we can accomplish what we're here to accomplish, what's 7 years? What's 20 years of hard work? As long as I'm honest, as he tells Lavan later, I never became dishonest like you did. I maintained my honesty. I maintained my integrity. I'm a happy man. I worked for it. I worked to teach the world about truth. That's great. It's a different plane. That's what it means to be a Jew. What it means to be a Jew is to transition out of the instinctive, reactionary life that human beings have and to move to that higher plane. I just want to finish off with a follow-up question to this. How in the world do you do it? I mean, you know, it's hard to go through boot camp. It's hard to go through basic training. You've got to be a Hercules. You've got to have an incredibly strong constitution to put up with the demands of boot camp. How do you maintain your positive attitude? It says, Yivdu es Hashem besimcha, serve God with joy. How do you serve God with joy, if that's what it means? It means foregoing. Everything has to wait. It's not about you. It's not about your fulfillment. It's not about your pleasure. Just do the task at hand. Work for 70, 80 years, 120 years, and then you'll be happy that you did. Come on. How am I supposed to do that? We're only human. How am I supposed to do Zahirus and Zrizus when it's such a chore? It's such a burden. I know that if you're on that level, then you take it in stride, but how in the world do you get to that level? The answer is right in front of us. Torah meviyah liyadei zehirus. Torah brings a person to zehirus. And zehirus brings a person to zrizus. Torah. That's why Hashem gave us the Torah. If you study the Torah will allow you to enter into that new plane. But you have to study the Torah and absorb it and allow it to challenge our assumptions and all the premises with which we grew up. If we allow the Torah to be absorbed within us, we will see that world that Yaakov is talking about. You know, it says in that Ethics of the Fathers that was quoted, Imatao Saken, it goes on to say, if you live this life, like it says, eat bread with salt, drink water in a small measure, sleep on the ground. It says, Imatao Saken, I'm sorry, Uvetorah Ataamel, and toil in the study of Torah. Imatao Saken, if you do this, Ashrecha V'tovlach, you will be happy and everything will be good. Somebody once said, I'm sleeping on the ground, I'm drinking a little bit of water, I'm studying Torah all the time, it's good, it's happy and it will be good. I can't see how that can be. If you do it, you will be happy and it will be good for you. You got to do it. You got to taste it to know it. That is the power of Torah. Now, Yaakov Avinu himself taught us this lesson, because this is amazing. He left home when he was 63. By the time he's ready to marry Rachel, he's 84. Okay, and now I know he worked for 7 years, so 84, back up 7 years, 77. He left when he was 63. What happened between 63 and 77?
Did he study in the chamber?
Jacob had left, as the beginning of the Parsha, Jacob had left his parents to begin a personal exile that, unknown to him at the time, would include 20 years in the home of Laban, a mendacious rogue, who, as the Passover Haggadah says, attempted to uproot the Jewish people. Before going to Haran, Jacob spent 14 years at the Academy of Shem and Aver, a fact that the sages deduced from the chronology of the period. Surely, as great a man as Jacob did not need more years of study to become a scholar. He went there for a different reason. Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky explained that the first 63 years of his life he studied Torah with his father in an atmosphere insulated from the corruption of Canaan. Now he would be living in Haran, among people who were Laban's comrades in dishonesty. To survive spiritually in such an environment, he needed the Torah of Shem and Aver, for they too had been forced to cope with corrosive surroundings. Shem had lived in the generation of the flood. Aver had lived with those who built the Tower of Babel. Jacob's 14 years in their tutelage made it possible for him to emerge spiritually unscathed from his personal exile. That was his personal preparation for the coming ordeal. Whatever he studied, I don't know what the curriculum was, but when you immerse yourself in the study of Torah, you enter into a different world. When you are in that world, you can overcome all of the stuff that goes on in our physical lives. And if you don't believe me, you have to try it. Imata osekein, if you do it, you will find the sweetness, the happiness, and the goodness in every life, in every day of your life. Now, studying Torah is not a simple matter. The real idea of studying Torah, it forces you to make this transition, because when you sit down in front of a Torah master, I'm talking about like in a yeshiva, so they open up the page of the Talmud or whatever it is, and the Rebbe starts teaching. And you say, I disagree. Or you think to yourself, I disagree. It doesn't make sense. I look at it this way. And you argue it out, and you argue with your chavrusa, with your study partner, and you begin to see that there's another logic. There's a different logic, and there's a different set of assumptions that are made. And you feel like maybe your mind is like mincemeat, because you really don't understand what the Talmud is saying, and you got to keep at it, but little by little you start to think differently. And the purpose of Torah study is that it gives you literally a different das, a different knowledge, a different mind, a different way of thinking. We call it das Torah knowledge. And that's something that's a crown. To say that somebody possesses Das Torah is like a crown. And not everybody can get there. But we have, among us, we have you know, scholars. Last week we had one of us, Rebbeim from Baltimore, Rav Berkowitz. He gave a shir. I mean, it was incredible, the depth and the background and the breadth of knowledge and the ease with which he went from topic to topic, in depth analysis. He can't explain it. He can't explain it. But just as there's a Yaakov Avinu that can literally go through 20 years and still be calm and serene and take all of these challenges in stride and come out stronger and happy and productive, there's somebody called a Talmud Chacham, a Torah scholar, who literally, he has a different das, a different type of knowledge. And it didn't come overnight. It came from step by step working, learning Torah, challenging himself against the Rebbe, against the Talmud Chacham, asking questions, experiencing things, and getting advice, and making mistakes, and correcting the mistakes, and becoming more humble, and learning how to accept a higher opinion. All of these things, the Torah experience, enables you to transition into that new plane. And that's what we're really talking about over here. We're not talking about a quick fix. Zihirus. Okay. I know it's a daily routine. I got to sit down and I got to go through my checklist. Zrizus. I got to do this and that. We're talking about Torah Mevi'a Lidei. We're talking about something called a Torah life. A Torah life immersed in a certain type of study, a certain type of dialogue, a certain type of vocabulary, interaction with certain types of people that have gotten on this Torah wavelength. And if we are not there ourselves, and very few are, we have to attach ourselves to those people that are Das Torah people. We have to allow our lives to interact with their lives, because that will affect us in a very, very meaningful and direct way. And we can somehow get onto their plane with them. But that's what we're talking about. When we look at Yaakov Avinu, he's not like a television character. He is a transformed possessor of Das Torah. He is a Talmud Chacham. He is a Torah giant. He's a Torah personality. He thinks differently than mere mortals. And that's why he can say, 7 years, just a few days, because I'm focused on the mission. I know why I'm here. I'm not here for my own comfort. I'm not here for my own pleasure. I'm here for a mission. I'm a soldier of God. This is what a Talmud Chacham is. This is what a person who has immersed himself in Torah is. And this is who our father is. Yaakov Avinu is the Bechir Shebeyavos. He is like the choicest, the sages call him, he's like the perfect specimen to be our father. Of all the patriarchs, he distilled all of the midos of Abraham and Yitzchak, and what he possesses now is the kind of the model that's going to be now manufactured and going to be duplicated in the tribes and in their children and in all of us. This is what it is made of. Yaakov Avinu's legacy is the legacy of transitioning out of a life of instinct, a life of self-centeredness, into the life of service of God, Avodas Hashem. It is a life which requires immersion, but it is a life of true osher, of happiness and tov and goodness. This is who we should identify with in the person of Yaakov Avinu. Yes, thank you for your patience. You are also so attentive and.
I love everything that you said, and it's a good message. The contradiction for me, and I think there is one that needs to be maybe illuminated a little bit, is that many of the rabbis, from my reading, say that Yaakov was guilty of dishonoring his parents. That by making the decision to be away from home, as long as he was away from home 20 years, and depriving his parents of having their son with them, he committed quite an egregious sin,
mm-hmm.
of dishonoring his parents. So this, a Torah scholar would know better.
Yeah.
But wouldn't this be considered a joint decision?
Mm-hmm. Didn't they send him there in the first place?
His mother sent him there in the first place, and she did concur with the father as well as he got permission from God himself.
I want to just point out, first of all, before I try to answer your question, just to point out the fact, he was away from home. If you take the 22 years which he is held accountable for, but you add to it the 14 years of the study, he was really away for 36 years.
Right.
He was held accountable for 22 of them, which means he was not punished for the time that he spent studying. And the sages point out that the merit of Torah study is so great that one does not even violate the commandment of honoring one's parents. Mm-hmm. That is why, halachically speaking, if parents say to their child, "We don't want you to go to yeshiva," he is not duty bound to listen, because the merit of Torah study is above all. But getting back to the other years, it's kind of puzzling why he would be held accountable if, for one thing, his mother sent him there. I don't know the answer specifically, but generally, part of living a Torah life is to balance the various different aspects of our duties. And there's sometimes a person will, in the name of religion, the name of Jewish observance, will neglect certain aspects of their duties when it didn't have to be. And this may be, in fact, a symptom of what Rav Volba calls self-centered frumkeit. Sometimes a person will say, "Well, I can't spend time with you as I'm busy learning." And that may, it could be in the realm of halacha that's true, but it also could be that you're just being not nice. You're just being insensitive. And it's your own self-centered frumkeit that is saying to another person, "I don't have time for you." And that's your failing. So if I understand this idea correctly, what it's saying is that, granted, Yaakov Avinu was serving Hashem, and serving Hashem purely and wholeheartedly and with pure intent, perhaps there was a way to accomplish both at the same time when his parents would not have to be suffered. Maybe he could have just communicated with them. Maybe he could have sent them weekly letters, or called home once in a while, or sent emails, that kind of a thing. In other words, we have to balance the various aspects of our duties. And maybe that was not done to its maximum. But not to say that what Yaakov was doing was, not to say that therefore that invalidates all that he was doing. No. What he was doing was building the foundation for the Jewish people. Perhaps he could have also accommodated a little bit more.
Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to torahmediaatlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.